This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, find out how to protect your internet passwords and secure your online accounts. We'll talk to a cybersecurity expert about the hacking of a popular password management service and how you can stay safe online. Now, President Biden is in Mexico City today meeting with Mexican and Canadian leaders about a number of issues facing the continent, including immigration. Over the weekend, Biden made his first presidential visit to the U.S.-Mexico border, stopping in El Paso, Texas, where he met with Republican Texas Governor Greg Abbott, among others. The trip comes after the Biden administration announced a new immigration policy last week that would turn away more Cubans, Haitians, and Nicaraguans who cross the border from Mexico.
If you're trying to leave Cuba, Nicaragua, or Haiti, have agreed to begin a journey to America, do not just show up at the border. Stay where you are and apply legally from there. Starting today, if you don't apply through the legal process, you will not be eligible for this new parole program.
The policy also allows for 30,000 people per month from those three countries and Venezuela to be accepted into the U.S. legally if they have eligible sponsors, vetting, and background checks. These changes come as the full Title 42 immigration/health program from the Trump administration continues to work its way through the court system without a final legal determination. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the Biden administration's latest moves on immigration? What questions do you have about this policy? We're going to dig into more details in just a moment. What would you like to see the president or Congress do about immigration at the U.S.-Mexico border and border security? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Elise Cohen is an associate professor of political science at UW Green Bay. She's chair of the Public and Environmental Affairs Program there. Elise, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. It's great to be with you, Rob.
Can you talk through this policy as it applies to those three countries, Cuba, Haiti, and Nicaragua? And there's a comparable program, I think, in existence for Venezuela. Some additional rejections at the border, but a new pathway. What's going on?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So Venezuela came first back in October of last year with a similar rollout of a policy. And now this announcement is showing us an expansion for the Cubans, Haitians, and Nicaraguans. It's essentially a carrot and stick approach the administration is trying to take to manage the southern border crossings. And the stick aspect is sort of what you mentioned there in the introduction with that quote from Biden that you will be blocked from applying for asylum if you cross without authorization. And then the carrot part of the approach that the administration is going for is saying they will accept up to 30,000 people per month through humanitarian parole if they enter legally.
And the idea is that if you're in one of these now four countries, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, Elise, you can apply from your country of origin for this asylum. You don't present yourself at the border to apply in this way.
So one of the things that there is some praise around is that the administration is really plugging this new app, this mobile app, where people could apply in advance instead of having to go arrive at the border and wait in long lines of hundreds or thousands of people to go through the asylum appointment request, that they could just use this mobile app on their smartphone to request the appointment. So theoretically, that could really help and provide a more dignified, orderly way for people to apply. But the other part of that is that the appointments would need to be timely. You know, if the asylum appointment would still be 1 or 2 years away, it's unlikely that it would really deter people from finding other ways to irregularly cross the border.
And I guess if I'm a poor person in Haiti living, under some kind of threat, do I have a smartphone? Do I have access to this at all?
Exactly. That's another really important point. So many people in Haiti right now, for example, are facing acute food insecurity and threats of kidnapping and gang violence. So it's not clear how able they would be to access this kind of process in an orderly way, especially since many of them have already left to go to a lot of other countries in Latin America or the Caribbean in the meantime. So there are a lot of criticisms that this rollout of policies is facing.
And then that's kind of on the carrot side, this app that would allow people to apply from their country of origin. The stick side. Now, some pro-immigration advocates are saying, wait a minute, isn't this the same sort of thing that the Trump administration was doing, making it harder for people who present themselves at the border or enter at a non-legal crossing point to claim asylum and just being rejected without any kind of hearing? Is that comparable to what we've seen in the previous administration?
Yes, that is a really important point of contention, because those critics are saying this is kind of like the Trump era transit ban for that rule that they've also announced, that if the migrant has traveled through another country en route to the U.S. to apply for asylum, that they would also then be disqualified because they should instead go ahead and apply for asylum in Mexico or Panama, whichever other country they had passed through. And when the Trump administration tried to do that through what was called the Safe Third Country Agreements, that faced all sorts of criticisms and legal challenges for blocking the fundamental right to asylum. So that is one of the main parallels where we're seeing critics say, how is this different from the Trump era use of that kind of transit ban? And then, as you mentioned, the expansion of Title 42. This was associated with the Trump administration under the sort of guise of a public health ordinance with the pandemic. But the way the officials now are speaking about using it to enforce immigration restrictions, it's pretty clear that it's not about public health at this point. It really is just being used as an immigration restriction tool.
Talking to Elise Cohen from UW-Green Bay, looking at the latest immigration announcements from the Biden administration, making it easier to send people back from the southern border in many instances, giving some pathways to people from selected countries to apply for asylum from their home country. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions, your questions. What do you think about the president's visit to the U.S.-Mexico border, his first of his presidency? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. At least Title 42, it gets complicated here. As you say, it was a health initiative used at the U.S. border, though. The Biden administration trying to end this Title 42, getting blocked in the courts, but also with this new announcement using Title 42 as a justification for rejecting some people at the border. Can you help sort that out for us a little?
Yes, well, you've really hit the nail on the head in terms of the confusion, because on one hand, the administration has criticized Trump's use of Title 42 from the moment his presidential campaign, Biden's presidential campaign, unfolded, and was really trying to dismantle it in the courts. When it was upheld by a federal judge brought on by Republican lawsuits trying to keep it in place, the administration says, we will continue to fight against Title 42. We recognize it is inhumane. It is misusing public health as an excuse to block illegal access to asylum. But now that there's this expansion of Title 42 expulsions, meaning expelling people rapidly without really giving them a chance for due process to fully go through credible fear and that kind of screening process for asylum, it seems like the administration is fully embracing that Title 42 is an easy shortcut to go ahead and expel people very quickly without having to go through the bureaucratic processes and affording them their rights. So this is really quite a conundrum, and it's interesting to see how administration officials are trying to walk that line between saying this is orderly and safe and humane, while at the same time defending something that in the courts they've been ostensibly, you know, fighting against.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Joanne is with us in Madison. Joanne, hi.
Hi. I'm calling about immigration from other countries other than Central America. I have a family member who married someone from Thailand. They've applied for a spousal visa. They've been waiting well over a year just to get any kind of word, let alone a decision. And so I'm wondering if there's anything in the bill that addresses the amount of time that it takes for people who are trying to come to the country legally.
Joanne, thanks for the call. My understanding, Elise, from this executive action over the last few days is this is pretty targeted toward Central and South America and asylum seeking. Do I have that right?
Yes, one of the big changes has been the origins and where these migrants are coming from. So as your caller mentions, it's beyond the northern Central American countries, what we think of as the Northern Triangle. Now it's really looking at Cubans, Haitians, Venezuelans at a new level that we haven't seen. I mean, especially Cubans and Haitians, we haven't seen this level of crossings or interdictions, even, you know, maritime interdictions at the sea since the 1990s. So it's a really big change in who these people are. And that's what this new announcement is focused on. Your caller is right, though. Joanna is right in bringing up just even the long wait time through other legal channels for migrants of other countries. And so that's kind of the root cause that isn't getting addressed with these policies is the tremendous backlog in the immigration court system and the tremendously long wait time for legal pathways to enter this country.
Joanne, thanks for calling. Good luck to your family member. We're talking to UW-Green Bay political science professor Elise Cohen about changes to the Biden administration's immigration policy and his weekend visit to the U.S.-Mexico border. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the U.S.-Mexico border, the asylum process, these latest changes from the Biden administration? What do you want to see from the president, the courts? And how about Congress? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Elise Cohen, political science professor at UW-Green Bay, with us today to talk about immigration policy and President Biden's visit to the U.S.-Mexico border over the weekend. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with this policy from the Biden administration to turn away migrants from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela who arrive at the U.S.-Mexico border seeking asylum? How about the idea of giving them a way to apply for asylum from their home country? Big picture, what changes do you want to see, if any, at the southern border? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to our callers. Don is with us in Lafarge. Don, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call there. I was just saying the problem seems to be that the bureaucracy is a bottleneck. I can't see how, if you've got waiting periods and, you know, lines that you have to wait in for years and stuff. I mean, not literal lines, but, you know, the waiting period. It's just going to cause all kinds of it's going to create a whole set of new problems. And I'm afraid we're just going to have to spend some money to kind of increase the bureaucracy to process these people. And I don't even mean, you know, let everybody in. I just mean, to let in some reasonable percentage of people that, you know, would like to. I mean, as has probably been said, most of us who are at least European Americans here in the U.S., you know, our background is immigrants.
Don, thanks a lot for the call. And Elise, I think we've talked about this before, especially regarding asylum. There aren't a lot of asylum judges, not enough to keep up with demand, which is why I think something like Title 42 just kind of short circuits that process. What do you think of Don's point?
Yeah, Don is absolutely right in using that phrase of a bureaucracy bottleneck. That's one way we could put it. And part of this is the withholding of congressional funding for having an expansion of the immigration court system and more of those immigration judges to move things at a faster speed. So, you know, one thing that we see with this announcement is that Biden is trying to expand further the use of the humanitarian parole as a sort of quicker way through executive power because of the bureaucratic backlogs and because of things like the inability of the chambers in Congress to come up with legislation that can actually move things forward. So that's why we see these non-traditional, you know, giving parole to these groups as the carrot side of the approach. And parole is only temporary. It's only up to 2 years for those who legally enter and qualify. And there is work authorization, but they would have to then apply for asylum and go ahead and kick the can down the road, so to speak, for that backlog in the asylum courts to have a permanent pathway to stay here and remain safe. So yes, we have to find a way to address the immigration courts and the lack of judges in order to move things forward at the root level.
Thanks a lot for that call. Jim joins us now in Beaver Dam. Jim, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking the call. So I understand with Haiti and the natural disasters and the need for, you know, assistance in whatever fashion we can give. But my question basically is on the South American problem. Now, I get it, man. There's this, the cartels down there, they're brutal. And they're doing all this really nasty stuff to their own people and, quite frankly, to us also. And so my question is, how is the problem ever going to get fixed if the people who live there aren't in a position where they have to take care of their problem? And yeah, yes, granted, we need to help. We absolutely do, because whatever the solution ends up being, we still have this massive wild bear on our border that needs to be dealt with.
Jim, thanks for the call. Elise, the problem's driving people to want to leave these countries in the first place.
Yeah, that's a really important point to highlight. So as Jim mentions, you know, what is going on in countries like Cuba, for example. So in Cuba, the political repression has really intensified. There were widespread protests in 2021. And then following those protests, people were mass detained and there were criminal prosecutions of people just for being opposed to their government. So, you know, what Jim is speaking about, what about the people themselves organically trying to change their government system, you know, to make their country safe or prosperous to remain in? Well, what we see is some of these authoritarian regimes, like in Venezuela and in Cuba, they are oppressing those people that would try and make that kind of change organically. And so that's part of the picture for why people are being displaced, not just the pandemic and the economic issues, but real issues of political repression and human rights violations.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Elise Cohen, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW Green Bay, looking at the latest Biden administration policies at the U.S.-Mexico border. Back to your calls now. Sherilyn is with us in Delavan. Sherilyn, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I grew up in El Paso, Texas, so I know this issue intimately. And, you know, the policy of accepting folks from these four countries that apply locally is a good policy only if we provide money to those companies or countries to help them get the news out to their folks before they hit the road. But bigger than that, Congress needs to adopt a rational immigration policy. This has gone on way too long. It's ridiculous. The humanitarian issues are immense. And we are a country that is supposed to honor amnesty, and I don't know how we get to that until Congress acts. But I think this is the first step that Biden has tried to do within his power, but it will require money to make sure that those folks from those four countries know what the expectations are.
Sherilyn, thanks a lot for calling. Elise, I want to key in on one thing Sherilyn was saying there about Congress not getting in on this. It seems like with Obama and Trump and now Biden, they're looking at their presidential authority, using it as much as they can. The courts might approve, they might not. Absent action by Congress, we're just going to keep having these kind of problems, right?
Yeah. Sherilyn absolutely brings up this crucial point at the core of what's happening with the expansion of parole and non-traditional ways of trying to address things, because we really haven't seen a bill that received bipartisan support for immigration reform since 2013. Now, that bill had bipartisan support in the Senate. We're talking about nearly a decade ago. And since those 10 years have passed, Congress has only become more politically polarized. And even back then, it was actually in the House of Representatives, really conservative members of the Tea Party at the time blocked that immigration reform bill from moving forward. And so no one would stand before us today and say that Congress is more willing to compromise. But if people really want to see permanent or more effective change that comes through actual legislation, it would need to be about pressuring lawmakers to be willing to compromise on immigration reform.
Sherilyn, thanks for that call. Lisa, I want to take our last couple of minutes to talk about the politics of President Biden's announcement and appearance at the border over the weekend. As you've mentioned, some pro-immigration advocates unhappy with part of this. President Biden receiving a lot of criticism from people who want less immigration at the southern border. Can you talk a little bit about the politics of this weekend?
Oh, yeah, that's a great point, Rob. The political campaign for the presidential election, it's hard to think about already, but it is now looming because it's coming up next year. And it's pretty clear that whoever the Republican nominee is will most likely make immigration a really central part of their campaign. So it seems like a lot of the photo ops and a lot of the press around Biden's visit, not only to El Paso, but to Mexico, is trying to highlight that he's not weak on border security, that there is a counter response to these Republican or conservative attacks, that there's an open border. He's trying to show that he is cracking down, that he can be tough, that he's focused on enforcement priorities. So what will be interesting to see is if he's able to overcome the divisions within his party around these kinds of issues and the criticisms he faces among liberals to try and court some of those more independent or conservative voters, which clearly he has in mind, you know, thinking ahead to the elections next year.
In just our last half a minute, what are you watching for in this meeting with leaders of Mexico and Canada?
Well, I think it's going to be really interesting to see how much Mexico will be willing to continue to help with enforcement and deterring migrants, and in exchange for what. It's pretty clear that the president of Mexico and President Biden have a transactional relationship. So sort of what are they going to hammer out in terms of what will work both for their own interests? And that's really what I'll be looking for, as well as to see, you know, the legal aspects of Title 42. Listeners may want to just keep an eye on that, because next month there's going to be the arguments in the Supreme Court over whether Title 42 will be kept in place.
Elise, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much. Great to be with you, Rob.
That's Elise Cohen, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. She was with us today to talk about immigration from South and Central America and recent changes to the Biden administration's policies as President Biden spent the weekend visiting the U.S.-Mexico border, now meeting in Mexico City. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, the world of professional bodybuilding has seen a number of scandals lately, including sexual harassment and abuse and unsafe treatment of athletes. Find out more with one of the Washington Post reporters who broke that story and join in the conversation. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You know what we could use right about now? A good old-fashioned comet in the sky, and we may be in luck. As reported by NPR, NASA is tracking a comet that we could get a look at by the end of the month. It's got a catchy name, C/2022E3. It can be hard to predict how bright a comet will be, but there's a good chance it'll show up as a bright, green, glowing object in the sky. The comet's orbit takes us toward the sun until January 12th, then it heads in for its close-up for Earth by the beginning of February. Let's define close. The closest this comet will get to Earth is 26.4 million miles. Put that in perspective, the driving distance from Superior to Racine is a little over 400 miles. Earth to the moon, it averages 239,000 miles. We're talking about 26 million miles here. We should still get a look at it. Keep watching this space for more info as it gets closer. Close enough for astronomy. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, former Natural Resource Board Chair Fred Prehn finally resigned at the end of December, more than a year after his term technically ended. We'll talk about the departure as well as the arrival of Governor Evers' appointee to be the new secretary of the DNR. Now, password management services are supposed to make accessing online accounts safe and easy. They let users store info like website logins and passwords, keeping them secure but accessible from anywhere. 3 days before Christmas, LastPass, one of the largest of those password management services, announced that hackers had potentially stolen data from all their users. The CEO of LastPass says the most sensitive info, the passwords, for example, were encrypted when stolen, giving an extra layer of protection against cyber thieves. But our next guest recommends all LastPass users act now to stay safe. What can you do to secure your online accounts? How protected are the passwords that can give anyone access to those accounts? Ketron Evans is the principal cybersecurity advisor at the InfoSec Institute. They have offices in Madison. They're part of the education technology company Cengage Learning Group. Ketron, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with what's probably a burning question on the minds of any LastPass user. What should I do now that I've heard about this hack?
Yeah, well, you should definitely change all your credentials, your LastPass login password, reset and redo your two-factor authentication. But more importantly, or perhaps just as importantly, is you should make sure that you change all the passwords of the accounts that you are protecting with LastPass. I think some people forget the fact that LastPass or password vaults are a location that you store your credentials, username, and password to other locations, so where you can have single sign-on or you don't have to remember a bunch of different passwords. So I think it's important to understand that that vault was compromised. So it's not just your LastPass password, but all the accounts that you're protecting and using with LastPass, those passwords need to be changed as well.
And the biggest worry, maybe that magazine subscription isn't such a big deal, but that bank account or that credit card login, those are the kind of things that could really do damage, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one thing that people forget too is with LastPass and other vaults like this, one of the nice features is as you're browsing the internet and setting up new accounts, the plugins that you have in your browser will say, do you want to add this account to LastPass as well? So there may be accounts in there that you've forgotten about that has your password in it as well. So you definitely want to just check in there and make sure you look at and go and change all the credentials that you have in LastPass.
Now, people might be thinking, wait a minute, I do something like LastPass or other password management system to be safer if they're vulnerable to hacks. Should I do them in the first place? What do you tell people?
Well, what I tell people is, number one, any organization is susceptible to being compromised or hacked. I've watched over the last 20 years where an organization gets hacked and then a competitor says, ha, 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 look at these guys getting hacked. And then, a year later, that organization gets hacked. So we have to be realistic here and understand that any organization is susceptible. We've had really high secure government agencies. We've had some of the top cybersecurity firms in the world to be compromised as well just in the last couple of years. So anyone is susceptible. And I don't think you should really make your decision based on a company having a data breach. It's just a matter of how well they handle it and how they responded to it. So I would say don't necessarily jump ship, just tidy up how you manage these things and get into the habit of changing your passwords on a regular basis anyways.
Now, when I log into a lot of accounts that use passwords on browsers, the Chromes, Firefoxes, Explorers, Safaris, you name it, they'll offer me the opportunity to save it or to remember it on that browser for the next time I come back. Should I or shouldn't I?
Well, I think that question depends on your susceptibility to forgetting it and writing it down, because what we've learned over the years is when users aren't given the opportunity to do things like that, they tend to either A, pick very weak passwords and use the same one everywhere because they know they won't forget it, or they do things like write them down or store them in a Word document. And we, over the years, the data tells us that that's actually worse, than allowing your browser to save your passwords and things like that. So just from a pure operation standpoint, and to some extent, just minimizing the amount of security incidents the average end user may have, it's probably okay to have have those passwords remembered.
So writing them down is bad. I get that. What if we want to step up and use that two-factor authentication? People may run into that phrase and not know what it is. What is it? How do we do it? When should we use it?
Sure, absolutely. My answer to that is you should use two-factor authentication everywhere you can use it. If you can use it when you log into your bank account, you should be using two-factor. And essentially what two-factor is when we look at authentication, which is what a password is, there are several different factors. One is something you know, which would be your password. Another factor would be something you have, which could be your cell phone or a security token or something along those lines. And then a third factor might be something you are, which would be your fingerprint, your iris scan, something like that. So we recommend with two-factor using is something you know, which would be your password, and generally something you have, such as your cell phone. And what happens is when you log in and put your password in, now that authentication system will send you a text message or send you a message to an app on your phone that you have to then open and confirm that it's you logging in. So therefore, a hacker grabbing or compromising just your password is not enough for them to authenticate to your account.
What's your advice for coming up with good passwords in the first place?
So I have a couple of things like that. For one, you want to try to use phrases. You know, today I'm talking on Wisconsin Public Radio to share password information. You know, you could use an entire phrase like that and do some substitutions such as changing A's to at symbols to where you have a very long phrase that has letters, numbers, and characters. So that's one thing. But another thing is also just taking a phrase, you know, today Keetron's wearing a red shirt, and just take the first letter out of each word in that phrase and make that your authentication string. Therefore, you're not actually using a word, because one of the problems here is the naming. You know, we call it password, so the average user thinks you have to use an actual word, which is the last thing you should be doing, because words are easier to crack. So getting people into the habit of saying passphrase or password string and understanding that your password doesn't have to be an actual word can help to increase the security of that quite a bit from just a pure mathematical cracking standpoint.
Keetron, we'll leave it there. Thanks for the advice today.
Absolutely.
Keetron Evans is the principal cybersecurity advisor for the InfoSec Institute. He joins today with advice on protecting our online passwords after the recently announced hack of the password management service LastPass. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a dream about hibernation.
Trolls are everywhere you look in the Dane County village of Mount Horeb. Troll cartoons on the street signs, troll footprints on the sidewalk, sculptures of trolls lining Main Street. The sheer number of trolls in the community prompted a Wisconsin listener to ask, what's the deal with all the trolls? WPR's Tim Peterson went to find the answer.
Over the years, Leah Jaber has frequented a Mount Horeb tea shop with her family. During each visit, the trolls always got the attention of the Madison East High School senior. You know, trolls, those ugly and dim-witted, yet powerful ancient figures from Norway's pagan past. To satisfy her curiosity, Jaber reached out to WPR's Wisconsin.
The biggest thing that got me curious is basically just seeing all the trolls, but having no idea where they came from or what they represent or what they mean.
I invited Jaber to join me to find the answer in Mount Horeb, officially trademarked the troll capital of the world. We meet at the Mount Horeb Area Historical Society, where Destiny Udelhoven is the director. She says they get asked about the trolls constantly.
What's the deal with the trolls? That's like exactly how they ask it.
Udelhoven says the abundance of trolls harkens back to the area's Norwegian heritage and a marketing push to attract visitors.
I think that's what I want people to see as a historian, is that the trolls didn't spring out of nowhere. We didn't pick them because they were just the most marketable thing. You know, they really have a strong, deep connection to our history here.
That connection being two major waves of Norwegian immigrants to the Mount Horeb area in the mid and late 19th century. Mount Horeb is known for its lasting Norwegian culture, a living museum outside of town with Norwegian-style buildings, annual Norwegian musical performances, and a water tower covered in rosemaling, a stylized Norwegian floral painting. In the 80s, a Mount Horeb resident was also crafting two-dimensional birch bark trolls. Jaber saw these up close at the Historical Society.
So you can walk down this little crevice and you can see, you can be surrounded by the trollness of them. Go ahead, you're the one who asked. Yes. Go down there, experience it.
They're definitely different than the carved trolls because they're painted kind of realistically. So yeah, I guess I'm a tiny bit scared, but I think it's kind of like joyous energy, I guess.
The carved trolls, the ones you may have seen lining Main Street, the chicken thief, the mayor. Local artist Mike Feeney did most of them.
I kind of get a kick out of them because they're humorous. They're a little bit off-center. Trolls really are not like the kind of cuddly things that you want to bring home. The Norwegian trolls are mean and nasty. They'll poison your well. They'll burn your crops. But the Mount Horeb ones are more like the New World trolls, a little happier, a little more jovial, and a little bit off-kilter.
Feeney was commissioned by the village in the 1980s to solve a marketing problem. That's according to Jim Leary, professor emeritus of folklore and Scandinavian studies at UW-Madison. He's also a longtime resident of Mount Horeb.
In the 70s, folks in Mount Horeb were realizing that the construction of the 18-151 bypass would route traffic away from their town, and how could they get people to come in? And so there was a meeting of minds about what kind of theme to emphasize, and they did surveys, and Norwegianness seemed to be something that they could ballyhoo a little bit.
Not everyone in the village loved the trolls right away, and Feeney says some came around when they started getting results.
They kind of fought for their existence, the trolls did, and then the people behind them really enjoyed them, and then apparently they brought a lot of people coming to town, taking their picture in front of the troll.
And while the trolls aren't for everyone, many locals will tell you they're lucky. And in this village, trolls are the protectors of the residents, the businesses, and nature.
WPR's Tim Peterson brought us that story on Mount Horeb's trolls. And that story idea came to us from an audience question as part of WPR's Wisconsin. Submit your question and we might answer it. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, a holdover leaves the Natural Resources Board long after his term expired as Governor Evers appoints a new head of the DNR. We'll check out the latest news in natural resources here in Wisconsin. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're catching up now on some developments over the past few weeks that could have impacts on environmental policy here in Wisconsin. In the last week of 2022, Governor Evers appointed Adam Payne to replace Preston Cole as Secretary of the Department of Natural Resources. A few days later, Fred Prain resigned from the Natural Resources Board, which sets policy for the DNR. We've talked about Prain on the show. He was a Scott Walker appointee. He refused to leave the board for more than a year after his term technically ended, after the state Senate took no action on his appointed replacement. Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior covering the environment, energy, and northern Wisconsin. She's been following both of these stories. Danny, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Let's start with this Fred Prain saga. A lot of twists and turns here. Can you talk about, first of all, why he was still on the board well after his term of appointment had ended?
Yeah, well, he was still on the board because he just refused to step down after the end of his 6-year term, which expired at the in May of 2021. He had been there and appointed, as you said, by Governor Scott Walker. But he said that he was not going to step down and that he believed that there were some issues related to PFAS and nitrates and wolf management that could use his leadership on the board. And so he remained in his seat, really sparking a controversy that has lasted until he exited the board just last week or at the end of December.
And Governor Evers had appointed a replacement to take his spot at the end of the term. The state Senate didn't confirm that replacement. And so Prain argued, well, there's nobody here, so I have to stay on the job. And the state Supreme Court ultimately agreed with them, right?
Yeah, the state Supreme Court did rule that nobody has to remove themselves from that position, that he could have held over in his seat, and that a vacancy is only created when a person dies or resigns or is removed for cause. But as we've seen throughout history, there's a lot of precedent for board members to make way for the incoming appointee or nominee. And that has happened. It's largely been the case. There's only been at least two cases that I can recall since the early 2000s where board members have refused to step down from their post. And that's happened under both political parties, both Republicans and Democrats. And so usually it's a little bit more civil as far as the political actions on this board. You know, it's the board that sets policy for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. But with the Republican-controlled legislature and a Democrat leading our state from the governor's office, this has been a bit more politically tumultuous than we have seen in years past.
And adding to the controversy, there were some communications between Prain and Republican leaders about his decision to stick around. In one case, saying in effect until a Republican governor wins the 2022 election. What do we know about those communications?
Yeah, and those communications came as the result of a separate case, an open records case against Fred Prain, to try and get more information or background about why he decided to stay on the board, right? And so this was a case that was brought by Midwest Environmental Advocates, and text messages from his phone and other devices showed that he sought to maintain conservative control of the Natural Resources Board. And this has been widely reported by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that Prain sought advice from conservative lobbyists and state senators, former Governor Scott Walker, and former Republican candidate for governor Rebecca Clayfish. Like you alluded to, he even wrote a text to one individual saying, "I'll see if I can hang on until Becky gets in." So clearly there were some political motivations here for why he decided to remain on the board.
And now the saga ends. Fred Prain is stepping down from the board. Did he give an indication of why now?
When he issued his letter of resignation, he said it was time for state legislators to act on Governor Evers' nomination and that it was time for him to move on. He did take an opportunity to get in some final digs at the Evers administration, saying that, you know, there have been repeated actions where he felt the administration has ignored statutes or policies that have been developed over the years, and that the administration has gone rogue as far as many of its decisions to regulate natural resources across the state. Yeah, I think it's just like a difference of opinion of what we're seeing here in Wisconsin. You know, he obviously has his own idea of how natural resources should be managed in Wisconsin, and that is quite different than how Democratic Governor Tony Evers and his appointees see that natural resources should be overseen here in our state.
Talking to Danielle Kading, WPR reporter, about some big stories at the DNR, the Natural Resources Board. Well, Danny, you just mentioned the governor's appointees just made a big one. Preston Cole stepped down at the end of the current of the governor's first term in office. And now we have a new DNR secretary designee anyway. What do we know about Adam Payne?
Yeah, so Governor Evers appointed Adam Payne just in the last week of December, after you mentioned that Secretary Preston Cole announced he was retiring and stepped down in November. And Payne has been serving as the Sheboygan County Administrator for the past two decades, and he's overseen development of the county budgets there, as well as program policy changes, including guiding the county through the cleanup of the Sheboygan River and Harbor. And he's also overseen a project to preserve more than 300 acres of undeveloped Lake Michigan shoreline at Amsterdam Dunes. And he also has a background leading the Wisconsin Land and Water Conservation Association as its executive director. So he's got a background in conservation and also as an administrator. And so he'll be stepping into that role at a time when there are some big issues that are coming up for the board.
And I wanted to ask you about that. A new DNR secretary, a change in the DNR board. You are reporting on these issues. What is on your mind? What are you watching for in 2023?
Well, one of the key ones has been PFAS, these harmful forever chemicals that don't break down easily in the environment and can lead to harmful health effects like kidney and testicular cancers, thyroid disease, and other issues like fertility. And so what we've seen so far is that the state has actually taken steps to enact drinking water and surface water standards for those chemicals, but it failed to enact groundwater standards for PFAS in the state. And the board recently launched the process of crafting regulations for four PFAS chemicals moving forward. And so the board will oversee whatever happens with that. And there are going to be some terms or positions opening up when several board members, their terms are expiring this year. And so it'll be interesting to see if they decide to remain in their seats or if they'll be stepping down to make way for any new appointees.
Danny, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior, covering the environment, energy, and northern Wisconsin. She talked with us today about two big stories on natural resources here in the state. By the way, next Monday at 4:15, the new DNR secretary appointee, Adam Payne, will join us here on Central Time. If there's something you want us to ask the new secretary of the DNR, an issue that's important to you when it comes to natural resources in the state, send us a note right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we can do a lot of things online. That doesn't mean we necessarily should. According to the author of the new book, The Future is Analog, How to Create a More Human World. And we'll take a tour of children's museums around the state and some new exhibits for 2023. And you can share your favorite children's museum or other children's activity in your community. Again, you can get us started right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we talk to an economist about recent increases to the minimum wage in many states around the U.S., but not here in Wisconsin, and the impact it can all have on workers. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.